From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, new jobs numbers, Mitt Romney's tax or penalty tussle, a big bank rate-rigging scandal, and the God particle. Republican bigwigs fumed as the Romney campaign swerved back and forth on whether the Obama health care reforms raised a penalty or a tax. On the 4th of July, Romney went with tax.
The Supreme Court has the final word, and their final word is that Obamacare is a tax. So it's a tax.
The chief executive of the big bank Barclays resigned this week in the fallout from a big interest rate rigging scandal. Bob Diamond, now the former CEO, was scathing of others.
That behavior was reprehensible. It was wrong. I'm sorry. I'm disappointed. And I'm also angry.
And Ralph Hoyer, Director General of the European Organization for Nuclear Research, CERN, announced the discovery of the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle, the stuff of the universe.
As a layman, I would now say, I think we have it. You agree?
Yeah.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Chrystia Freeland of Thomson Reuters, Doyle McManus of the LA Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Where are the jobs? And what's up with the Romney camp's tax penalty swerve? What's your top story this 4th of July week? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. From New York, we're joined today by Chrystia Freeland, editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. Chrystia, welcome back. Great to have you.
Great to be with you, Tom.
From Washington, Doyle McManus is with us, Washington columnist for the Los Angeles Times, read in many fine newspapers around the country. Doyle, it's wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Mr. 4th of July, Jack Beatty is here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Chrystia, and Doyle.
All right, here are these numbers. 80,000 created in the month reporting today. 80,000. People were hoping for 90, and that wasn't even a very high hope. Chrystia, what do you see in this number, 80,000?
I think it's really worrying. It's weaker than people had hoped, and expectations were relatively weak. I think that it shows that the U.S. economy is not out of trouble yet, and that is particularly worrying because there isn't some great global engine of growth that can rescue the U.S. or the world. The fact is that the Europeans and even to some extent the emerging markets have been counting on the U.S. to pull out of the recession. And, you know, although it's not a double-dip recession yet, the recovery is certainly anemic, especially when it comes to jobs, which for me is the single biggest problem.
Chrystia, we heard this week that manufacturing, which had come on pretty strong in the years since the bust, also slipping, reports are this week. I mean, what is the ground that's slipping away here in these poor numbers? Where was the growth before, where it's not now? What's evaporating?
Well, look, I think the really big picture is that, and, you know, this is something that you see in the economic literature, that recoveries from financial crisis-caused recessions are always much slower than recoveries from a normal recession. There's a big bubble that burst, and there's a lot of deleveraging, not so much on companies' balance sheets, but on the balance sheets of the banks, on the balance sheets of individual people, right, all those underwater mortgages, and on the balance sheets of governments that had to spend a lot of money to bail the banks out. And, you know, the classic conclusion of the literature is it takes 7 years to recover from one of these crises. So that's just a long, painful time. I think what makes it worse is that in contrast with other periods of recession, the rest of the world is looking pretty weak. Europe in particular, but we're also seeing some worrying signs of slowdown in the economies that had been a real engine of growth right after the recession, places like China and India.
And Brazil. Doyle, I want to look at the politics. Let's listen to President Obama. He's been out on the road on his bus across northern Ohio, today into Pennsylvania, today bus tour through the Rust Belt. In Ohio yesterday, the president talked about the challenge of preserving opportunities for the middle class, and you can hear him acknowledging tough times.
And I know sometimes people feel like, yeah, you know, Obama, he's done some good things, but boy, things are still tough out there. Change hasn't happened fast enough. I understand that. I get frustrated too. But what's required are long-term solutions, not slick promises, not quick fixes.
Doyle McManus, he gets frustrated too, no doubt. How does this play out politically? Is this just a, you know, kind of a hand it to Romney dynamic here, or can the president turn this somehow to a stay in office strategy?
Well, it's not quite handed to Romney, but the voice you were hearing there was the voice of a candidate who would much rather be speaking in an environment where these numbers were turning up. And the Obama campaign had been hoping against hope that there might be, a better number. The forecasts were for 100,000 or more new jobs. We only got 80,000. So that leaves President Obama with a very tough row to hoe. He has to explain, as he was trying to do in that clip, why even though his 3 years of effort haven't produced the results he wanted, people should return him to office. And it makes it easier for Mitt Romney, who hasn't had the greatest month of any presidential campaign in history. Mm-hmm. It makes it a lot easier for Mitt Romney to stick to his fundamental message, which is very simple and very clean, and that is that President Obama has done a lousy job of stewardship of the economy.
And Mitt Romney had his surrogates out on the same trail, kind of shadowing the president, doing that in Ohio. This was Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal in Ohio, talking at a Republican rally yesterday.
This president's been bad for America. He's been bad for Ohio. Here in Ohio, over 40,000 fewer jobs than when he took office. Average income gone down $3,000. The list goes on and on and on, but the bottom line is this. We've had enough of broken promises. You want good-paying jobs in Ohio? You want a growing economy in America? We need to elect Mitt Romney.
Jack Beatty, what is this going to be about? Raw numbers? Jobs down? So, you know, change at the White House? Or President Obama is kind of making the argument for a vision, saying, look, we've got the right vision, we've got to stay with it, or we're in trouble. Is this raw numbers or vision? What do you see, Jack?
Probably psychology, you know, the sense of whether things are getting better or not, or worse. And the administration's effort to restore psychology, to sort of induce positive feelings, have been ludicrous. For example, just in 2010, how can we forget, that was, quote, recovery summer. Where is it gone? And when you look at the pattern of the past, you see the president's challenge. Running for re-election in 1992, President George H.W. Bush averaged 80,000 jobs a month in from January to November. 80,000, and he lost.
And that was not with 8.2% unemployment.
That's right. And running for re-election in 2004, President George Bush averaged 186,000. He won. President Obama now is at about 160,000 a month. Between them, not enough to really give him any plausible talking point about progress.
Where's the 160,000 a month? We're looking at 80,000 a month here. From last month.
I'm talking about the average since January and February when it was up to 250,000. Yep. Of course, now what's happening is it's coming down each month. And ominously, private employment was the weakest in 10 months. That had been, the president, remember, just last month was saying, you know, the private economy is doing fine. Not so fine, according to this.
Christian, what's the argument here then between these two candidacies? Is it? I mean, Romney seems kind of simple. In fact, so simple, some Republicans were griping this week. Bill Kristol in the Weekly Standard saying, come on, you can't just say it's the economy. You've got to talk about what you're going to do. Does Romney have to do that or just point at these numbers and say, hey?
Well, I think it depends on how bad the numbers get. You know, certainly this is the absolute center of concern of Americans, and it should be. And I think the Romney campaign has a very strong card to play in terms of saying, look, it's just really bad. You know, is America better or worse? Is your family doing better or worse than it did the day Barack Obama took office? I think that that is a very, very strong card for them to play. I think what is tougher for them, actually, is once they start talking about, okay, what would you do to make things better? Because then I think the Obama campaign can start getting into a discussion of how the current economic weakness really was something that Obama inherited from a Republican president. You know, there's no way that you can argue that the weakness in the economy today is something that was created on Obama's watch.
But here's all this sort of fulmination this week, Doyle, from Republicans about Mitt Romney. What's this about? Here's Bill Kristol again at the Weekly Standard, and he's saying, you know, hey, you know, it's not enough to say it's the economy. He asks, what is his, Mitt Romney's, growth agenda? What's his deficit reform agenda? What's his health care reform agenda? His tax reform agenda? His replacement for Dodd-Frank? And this is William Kristol, arch conservative, saying, what's up, Mr. Romney? Where's that frustration coming from, Doyle?
Well, that's right. And that's because the Romney campaign has actually had a bad month when it thought it ought to have a good month. As Jack noted at the beginning of the month, President Obama stuck his foot in his mouth and said the private sector is doing fine, so Republicans landed on him for that. But after that, you know, Mr. Obama has actually been using the advantages of incumbency fairly effectively. He has done things about gay marriage. He's done things about immigration. He's done things most recently filed a trade dispute against China. He's looking very dynamic. He's out there doing stuff, despite the fact that he's facing all these terrible economic numbers. Okay. In contrast to that, a lot of Republicans look at the Romney campaign and they say, what's he doing? What's he saying? It's static. He seems to be sitting there. This is their critique, simply waiting for these bad economic numbers to do his work for him. Now, I happen to think that's, oddly enough, an unfair critique, because the Romney campaign has a strategy, has a timing. They won't talk about what the specifics are, but they say, trust us, we know what we're doing. It's a very sort of corporate organization that may do things right or wrong, but they have a kind of steadiness there and they don't get panicked. So Romney does have economic specifics. He just thinks that this is the wrong time to roll them out. We're going to hear a lot more of them later on, and certainly beginning in at the convention in September. But there's enormous frustration in the Republican Party.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Mitt Romney's tax tussle, the God particle, new jobs numbers, and they're not pretty once again. Krista Freeland joins us. She's global editor at large for Reuters, Reuters Thomson Digital. Dole McManus is here, Washington columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and our own Jack Beattie joins us. More tempest, maybe in a teacup, maybe not, over language and the Romney campaign this week around health care reform. This was on Monday. A senior advisor to the Romney campaign told MSNBC's Chuck Todd that Mitt Romney did not consider the health care mandate to be tied to a tax, but rather an unconstitutional penalty. Here's top Romney aide Eric Fernstrom.
The governor believes that what we put in place in Massachusetts was a penalty. And he disagrees with the court's ruling that the mandate was a tax. But again,
so he agrees with the president, and he believes that you shouldn't call the tax penalty a tax. You should call it a penalty or a fee or a fine.
That's correct.
It's not a tax, says the Romney man. It's a penalty. That's correct. 4th of July, Mitt Romney came out from his short holiday there up at the lovely Wolfboro, New Hampshire, where he's got a big, beautiful home on the lake, and tried to align himself with, I guess, perhaps what he saw as a mainstream Republican view of the health care bill, that it is a tax.
Now the Supreme Court has spoken. There's no way around that. You can try and say you wish they had decided a different way, but they didn't. They concluded it was a tax. That's what it is, and the American people know that President Obama has broken the pledge he made. He said he wouldn't raise taxes on middle-income Americans. Not only did he raise the $500 billion that was already in the bill, it's now clear that his mandate, as described by the Supreme Court, is a tax.
Don McManus, interpret, please. Why do we have both these views coming out in one week from the Romney camp, and why so much unhappiness again in Republican quarters about it?
Well, it depends on which Mitt Romney you want to listen to. Look, for years and years, Governor Romney has been saying that the penalty in Massachusetts for failing to sign up and get insurance wasn't a tax, because he didn't want to be hit with the charge that he raised taxes in Massachusetts. Okay. So for many years, he's had a very clear position on that based on what he did in Massachusetts. Now, he's stuck where the Republican Party has looked at the Supreme Court ruling. The court says it's a tax. The Republican Party, except for Governor Romney, says this is terrific. We can attack President Obama for raising middle class taxes. And poor Mitt Romney is stuck between the old Governor Romney and the new presidential candidate Romney. Now, there was about a millisecond there where the Romney campaign tried to come up with the most sophisticated rationale in the world by saying, well, it's not a tax when a state does it, because that's done under a different clause of the Constitution.
Okay.
But it is a tax when the federal government does it. But they've sort of dropped that, because that one kind of didn't pass the giggle test.
Jack, what do you read in this wiggle?
The neuralgia when it comes to this whole issue for Mr. Romney, I mean, you know, as Paul Krugman today says, in a better world, he would be running on the Massachusetts program, tax or mandate or penalty, whatever you want to call it. It's popular. It's working. People are insured in Massachusetts, but it's against conservative orthodoxy to espouse that. So he's been saddled with it throughout the campaign, throughout the primary campaign, and now. You know, this whole question, though, of tax penalty, I think the Democrats are just as bad. I watched Nancy Pelosi on a Sunday show go through acrobatic lengths to say, oh, no, that's not a tax, that's a penalty. I mean, they can't say it's a tax. I mean, it's as if the Democrats are still unable to break out of the sort of fixation of the 1984 campaign, which is that if the Democratic Party ever says they're going to tax anybody who isn't a millionaire, they're going to lose. Well, you know, the bill has all kinds of taxes in it. And it, in fact, by 2020, it's going to be raising about $100 billion in revenue, of which $7 billion, fairly small, will come out of this, quote, mandate penalty tax. But the rest, most of it, will be coming out of a tax on, quote, Cadillac insurance plans, you know, very, very rich insurance plans that will essentially be trying to tax those away. But of course, that was a position espoused by Mr. McCain in 2008. And what did President Obama, candidate Obama, call it? The largest middle class tax increase in history. You just can't use the word tax in American politics.
Mitt Romney himself, this was back in 2008 when this came up in a GOP presidential debate. This was in New Hampshire in 2008. And he was, in that context, willing to talk about the kind of dynamic here that he planted in the plan in Massachusetts that was the model for President Obama's plan nationally. Here he was asked about it, talked about the health care coverage, and moving the conversation away from the consequences of being uninsured. But he didn't deny there were penalties, maybe tax penalties.
If you can afford to buy insurance, then buy it. You don't have to if you don't want to buy it, but then you got to put enough money aside that you can pay your own way. Because what we're not going to do is say, as we saw more and more people in this country doing,
you impose tax penalties in Massachusetts.
Yeah, we said, look, if people can afford to buy it, either buy the insurance or pay your own way. Don't be free riders and pass on the cost of your health care to everybody else.
ABC's Charlie Gibson there, and you heard him saying, Governor, you imposed tax penalties in Massachusetts. And Ron saying, yes, we said, you know, not denying. KK calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. KK, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
What I want to say is that Romney tries to have it both ways. But it was he who tried to urge President Obama to follow his example. Yet it was the same man who stood up there in the debates and said, oh, no, no, this is only good for the states. But if you look at his USA Today 2009 op-ed that he wrote saying, not so fast, what's the rush, Mr. President? In the fourth paragraph, he says that using tax penalties as we did in Massachusetts, or tax credits as others have proposed, encourages free riders to take responsibility for themselves rather than pass their medical costs onto others.
Yeah.
He called it a tax penalty.
KK, you're right on it, and we've got it, and I appreciate your call and pointing that out. I mean, a lot of this came from Republican plans early on where they didn't want free riders and saw that as kind of philosophically lined up with their view of the world. But now, a little different story. It's all about tax or no tax. Will in Charleston, South Carolina. Will, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes, sir.
So I know there's this debate about whether it's a tax penalty, and I guess what my question really is it tax, you know, is this kind of a budget neutral decision, or will taxes go up as a result of it? Because if you call it a tax, you know, and everyone doesn't want to raise taxes, if it's not going to raise our taxes, then what's the hubbub?
Yeah, you know? Will, let us pick it up. I mean, Christian, this gets into the meat of it, whereas this is not for everybody. This is if you don't have or you don't buy insurance, then there is a, call it what you will, call it a penalty, call it a tax. It's not like it's a general tax increase across all Americans. It's for those who, as Mitt Romney, I guess, once might have said, are trying to be free riders.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I do think, you know, if you talk to the administration, I spoke to Alan Krueger, the head of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, about this a couple of days ago. They absolutely insist, and I think with some credibility, that if you look deep within the details of the Health Care Reform Act, that it is fully costed out, that it does pay for itself, that there are cuts and increases that balance out. I think the bigger issue on costs that, you know, maybe the death panels argument by Sarah Palin has made Democrats scared of addressing directly is, at the end of the day, the only way the United States will contain rising health care costs is by letting the government get in there and contain them. Right now, the United States gets a terrible deal out of health care. The U.S. spends much more than any other Western developed country on health care, and the outcomes are comparable or worse. And, you know, the comparable experience of everybody else is the only way you bring those costs down is the government has to be the intermediary. That's the real issue when it comes to costs. It's not about is this a tax or is this a penalty. It is the, you know, is American society going to get its hands around health care and accept something that, you know, I think has been absolutely demonstrated by everybody else's experience?
But that doesn't sound like the memo that Mitt Romney's reading. He's saying we need more competition here. We need more private competition as the answer to health care costs, Christian.
Absolutely. And I don't think that's right. I think that, you know, what we have seen over and over again is the way you contain healthcare costs is you have to have the government involved. It's not like buying a pair of shoes. You know, you can have competition and I will go and buy the cheaper pair of shoes. But if I have cancer or I have a heart attack, I don't think I'm going to shop around for the cheapest option.
You have to have government involved. I guess that will be in part what gets decided in November. Wayne in Rutland, Vermont. Wayne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just so tired of the political semantics going on with the whole idea of whether this is a tax or a fee or a penalty. I mean, whatever political party or which way you lean, they change the name of it, but it's still money coming to pay for services that are going on. It doesn't matter what label you put on it, rose by any other name. What it's doing is distracting us from real issues in our economy, like infrastructure and jobs.
Well, I mean, healthcare is a real issue in the economy, but it's certainly not the only one. We take your point there, Wayne. I mean, Doyle, you've been writing recently, Doyle McManus, about how whether or not this whole thing even goes forward really does ride on the election that's in front of us. Whether the healthcare reform package and whatever you want to call it, the tax, the penalty, it's hinging on that November vote.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, to go back to the tax question for just a moment.
Yeah.
You know, when Republicans say this is a huge middle class tax increase, that's actually wrong, because the tax penalty, we can call it a tax or a penalty, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. I think, only falls on those people who don't get insurance. That could be 2%. It could be less. It could be a little bit more. Most of the taxes in this law actually come out of the hides of upper income people. They come out of the hides of employers, and they come out of the hides of insurers. Now, but Republicans have made repealing Obamacare, as they call it, and as the White House now calls it, a linchpin, an absolute pillar of their campaign. And whether Obamacare survives or not depends absolutely on exactly two elections, who becomes president and who gets a majority in the Senate, and also how big the Republican majority is if it's there. But it is an absolute lead pipe cinch that if Mitt Romney wins the presidential election, he will attempt to repeal Obamacare. If he has 50 or more Republicans, remember, at 50, his vice president, whoever that turns out to be, gets to cast the tying vote. Mm-hmm. He'll have a hard time repealing the whole thing, but he will be able to defund important parts of it through budget reconciliation, which only takes 51 votes, and that could potentially include repealing this very tax penalty that we are talking about.
We've got the economy on the line. We've got health care on the line, reform on the line. Jane in Dothan, Alabama. Jane, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling about the economy.
Yes, ma'am.
They say the economy is lagging because of lack of consumer confidence, and I think they're all wrong. I hate to say I'm smarter than the experts, but I have to live with my budget. I think the real culprit is inflation. I haven't lost confidence in the economy. I just do not have the extra money to spend that I had 10 or 12 years ago.
Is that because of your earning power, do you think, Jane, or higher prices, or both?
No, there is no reason for me to not have the money. So I went back through my financial records for 10 years ago to find out what was going wrong. Now, part of it is natural disasters has zoomed the homeowners insurance, and you can't blame that on either Republicans or the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But the other of it is just plain flat out. You go into a store one week, and the price is a dollar. You go back the next week, it's a dollar and a half. We're not talking about pennies. We're talking about big jumps.
Jane, we've got it. I appreciate you going back through your records and figuring out the arc of what you see going on there. I mean, Christopher Freeland, you've been writing recently about people, I think just like Jane, who in this maybe disappearing middle class time getting forgotten here. You get a lot of policymakers sitting around thinking about big questions, but not necessarily with Jane in mind, Christian.
Yeah, well, I would echo both what Jane and also what Wayne in Vermont said, that, you know, I think that obviously with the Supreme Court decision, healthcare is something that it's fun to talk about this week. I think ultimately, you know, what people care about, what people are voting about is jobs, and not just jobs, but even if you have a job, is your standard of living being eroded? I don't think that the numbers tell a story of inflation, but they tell a story of something that feels like inflation, which is even the people who have jobs are finding that their real incomes are decreasing. I mean, this is actually remarkable that if you look at family wealth, it is at the same place as it was in the 1990s. You know, Americans have had a lost decade,
yeah,
and middle class wages in many sort of sections of the population are actually declining. So that sense that you have less income to buy things, that your money isn't going as far as it did 10 years ago, that's not just an amorphous feeling. That is absolutely true for most Americans in the middle. And I agree that is the most urgent problem. And I don't think there's enough discussion around that.
Meanwhile, up at the tip top of the global economy, more reports this week of sort of wild hanky-panky going on. The whole business with Barclays Bank manipulating fundamental interest rates for profit. The CEO there, Bob Diamond, out, resigned Tuesday from his post as CEO, testified before Parliament here on Wednesday, said the bank didn't condone these actions, did its best to confront the situation.
This is wrong, and I'm not happy about it. But we put all the resources we could to make sure that the people that we knew that behavior was there were dealt with both the regulators in terms of anything that we can do in that regard. But this doesn't represent the Barclays that I know and I love, and it doesn't represent the work of 140,000 people.
Well, maybe not, and he can call it reprehensible, but Christopher Freeland, it's on his watch, and it's kind of staggering to think of manipulation up at this level of the structure of the global economy, Christian.
It's really shocking. I think it is what the English would call gobsmacking.
Mm.
LIBOR is an absolute...
This is the London exchange rate.
Mm-hmm. The London interbank rate.
Yep.
It is an absolutely central figure for actually the whole world economy. It is what the UK mortgage rate is set against. It's what is used as a benchmark rate for very, very many both commercial calculations and also calculations by central banks around the world.
And if you can put your thumb on that scale and manipulate it to your advantage, wow.
Right, right. I mean, the irony is that actually Barclays is accused of manipulating LIBOR down.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they could make the numbers up is terrifying.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, over 2 million people lost power as storms and wind up to 70 miles an hour crashed through the mid-Atlantic. Here was one senior citizen in Greenbelt, Maryland, waiting for power.
They told me 7 days. Who can wait 7 days with 100 degrees? My apartment is like an oven.
San Diego's 4th of July Big Bay boom was a big, bad bust. A technical glitch caused all of the fireworks, the whole fiery display, to go up in 15 seconds. Spectators had no clue what was going on. Listen as they try to figure it out. And actor Andy Griffith died of a heart attack at 86. His Andy Griffith Show, huge in the 1960s, evoked a sweet, simple vision of small-town America. Its theme song, Gentle Times and the Fishing Hole. Boy, does that sound nice and a long time ago. We're looking at a week in the news. Mitt Romney's tax tussle, the God Particle, Barclays and LIBOR, new jobs numbers. Christian Freeland is with us from Thomson Reuters Digital. Doyle McManus is here from the Los Angeles Times. Our own Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. Jack, I want to give you a swing at this Barclays Bank business. I mean, we've been watching and watching here for years now, all the stuff that's gone on with banks. And here, right in the wheelhouse of how interest rates are set, we're told there's manipulation going on by banks. And as Christa says, oh, down, up, whatever, it's for their profit. What is a little person supposed to do?
How are you supposed to have even elementary faith in such markets? And this, after the Klieg lights have been on for years on the malefactions of people in that world. I mean, it is, now, is it a case of the incentives are wrong, that there are bonuses connected with this? Who knows? But there seems to be some structural issue going on. This keeps happening, either dubiously legal ventures or things like that are just dubiously risky, like the Morgan Stanley.
J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan, mm-hmm. Yeah. But it just keeps happening, and it can't just be the personality type of people who get into this world. It must have something fundamentally to do with the unchanged signals within these institutions, which say, take risk, push it to the max, and you'll be rewarded.
Maybe beyond the legal max, here's an interview from Tuesday. This is Ed Miliband, head of the Labour Party in England, saying that rate fixing by Barclays was not just an isolated incident.
This is about much more than one individual. It's about the culture and practices of the banking industry. That's why we need a full, judge-led, independent inquiry to get to the bottom of those practices and make recommendations for change in the future.
We'll see what they get in the UK. We wonder what we'll get in the US. Pittsburgh. Steve is calling. Steve, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As far as Barclays is concerned, you really can't separate the global market into segments like that. The question for your guest is, the repercussions are going to be felt here in the United States, but who is the finger going to be pointed at specifically?
Let's see. I mean, we heard that the American accent of the CEO there, I think American, Bob Diamond.
Yes, he is.
Christia, does this come home somehow? You hear Miliband saying, we got to get to the bottom of this in the UK. Does this, too, have tentacles back to the USA or not?
Sure. Well, you're quite right. Bob Diamond did take out British citizenship, but I think one of the reasons that the sort of political system pushed him to resign so quickly is he is American, and he was very known and not universally loved for what were considered his American practices, paying himself very well, paying his top lieutenants very well, quite aggressive in the wake of the crisis. He said not too long ago that the time for breastfeeding and self-flagellation was over, and it
not
was
quite
time
over,
for banks
Bob. Not quite over.
To walk tall and proud. Also, of course, Barclays is the bank that took over Lehman. Mm-hmm. So they have a big presence here. I'd like to get back to the point that Jack made, because I think it is absolutely correct. And I think the issue is not purely about the culture within banks and within the financial sector. I think it's broader than that. And it goes back to this notion of self-regulation. The financial system actually has been built on this assumption that bankers can be trusted to regulate themselves. LIBOR was based on rates which bankers reported themselves to a committee which was run by bankers. And the U.S. practice is not that different. On the board of the New York Fed, who sits on that board? Jamie Dimon, whose bank, J.P. Morgan, is regulated by the New York Fed. So we have this network of practices that has been based on the assumption, which Alan Greenspan used to articulate, that these are very brilliant market players. And because they're so smart, because they have so much skin in the game, they are the best position to regulate themselves. They're smarter and better than dumb, underpaid government bureaucrats. Let's trust those smart masters of the universe. And I think that what we are learning, and we seem to have to learn it over and over again, is that if you're playing the game, you can't be the referee.
Yeah, that seems pretty straightforward. And yet here we are. I mean, Doyle, you've been writing not so long ago about when President Obama was going after Mitt Romney as a, you know, heartless capitalist. A lot of things are going to tie back into presidential campaigning here. If we've got scandal around big banks again, who does that favor? Who does that work against? Does that give President Obama some wind at his back or not?
Well, it may. It does play into the campaign. And to pick up on Chris's last point, okay, if you're the player on the field, you can't also be the referee. That means there has to be a referee. This one of the big debates here is about regulation. Do we need regulation? Is the Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill a good thing for the country, as President Obama says, or a bad thing, as Mitt Romney tends to say? Should it have the Volcker rule in it, which limits what the banks can do in terms of speculative trading? The banks don't want it. Obama does. So, yeah, absolutely. This will resonate in our own campaign.
Let's go to Scott in Des Moines, Iowa. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Regarding this LIBOR scandal, I think an even bigger one is just starting to show itself here in America with the municipal bonds. I don't know if you're familiar with Matt Taibbi.
Sure, we've had him on the show a few times.
Yeah, I thought I'd heard him on this show before. Mm-hmm. Well, he just had a great article out here about a week and a half ago, thereabouts, where our American banks have basically been doing the same thing. They've been bid rigging, you know, messing with interest rates to all the municipalities across the country, you know, with bond issues. In fact, three individuals were convicted. They haven't been sentenced yet. But I think when this starts to get, you know, more out in the general public's awareness, I think there's going to be a possible another crisis. It's you know, another case of bank fraud.
Scott, I appreciate your call. Christian Freeland, I mean, we don't need more systemic trouble. We've got enough just plain old economic trouble here. And you start talking about muni bonds and LIBOR and sort of a fundament of how the economy works. I don't know. Is there more to come on this front, Christian?
Well, I think there is probably a little bit more to come. And it is interesting that we have the Barclays Bob Dimon scandal coming very shortly after the Jamie Dimon J.P. Morgan bet that went wrong. So, you know, I think, you know, the scary lesson is, I think it was Jack who said, you know, the Klieg lights are on these guys. And even so, they're up to their old tricks. Having said that, you know, where I really worry, and I think the point about the municipal bonds is right, I think that the area we need to all be concerned about is sovereign debt right now. That's where we're seeing a lot of borrowing happening. Europe, but also, I mean, also various levels of government taking on debt. And,
you're
looks
looking
as
at even American municipalities, Stockton, California, declaring bankruptcy and all that.
Right. It looks as if, you know, a lot of those are going to go under. We've spoken about an allergy to taxes, certainly by American politicians. On the LIBOR scandal, an important point to make is what we've heard all along is that Barclays was not the only bank engaged in these practices. It was a collective behavior. So be prepared for headlines bringing down more heads of British banks.
Boy, great. Liz in Florence, Massachusetts. Liz, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hello. I actually formulated my comment much earlier in the show. However, I think my comment sort of still holds for...
Okay, let's have it.
I just was kind of set off by the Jindal Boner quotes that you had earlier, which are so simplistic and manipulative. And I have to say that it was people like Romney at Bain Capital who created the job climate that we have now today. Outsourcing, weakening unions by doing contract labor all the time.
Well, that sounds like the Obama campaign's take on Mitt Romney. That's certainly the case. Is it at this point, is it Obama's baby? Is it his responsibility, though, Liz?
Because Obama is not an emperor. Obama has to work with Congress, and Congress will not work with him. The Republicans have been obstructionists from the beginning. Their vision was to take down his presidency, and including throwing the economy and us under the bus doing it, and that's what they've been doing. So when they stand up there and say, oh, his stimulus package didn't work, it's really disingenuous because economists everywhere said that the stimulus package needed to be larger in order to be truly effective, and they made sure that could never happen.
Liz, we've got that perspective loud and clear, and we have heard it, and I'm sure we'll hear it again in the campaign headed for November. I appreciate your call. One more, London, Kentucky. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wanting to make a point earlier about the Barclays scandal. I think it has to do with the fact that in the 2008 scandal in America that there weren't criminal prosecutions of the bankers that ran our system into the ditch that we're in now. And I really think that unless we get that kind of level of seriousness with the problem, it won't be resolved.
Anthony, thanks for your call. Jack, still waiting for a little ferocity and pushback to banker, working the edges?
People still wait for that, and yet what I read, now maybe I'm reading the wrong things, is you really can't find much out-and-out illegality in the scandals that brought down our financial system, and that the real scandal is it was within the law. it was a matter of all this sort of, Baroque financing that was permitted by deregulation. And yes, there were some, at the margins, there was some mortgage misrepresentations and the like, but that the real scandal was our laws, and that gets back to the grip that money has on our politics, because the laws were changed under the Clinton administration because of the sheer weight of lobbying and money pouring into American
politics.
Well,
we could debate that all day. We've had guests on this show saying, no, there was plenty of structure that we just weren't willing to act on it. The world is bigger even than LIBOR. This was an interesting week all the way out in Afghanistan on the border with Pakistan, where after 7 months of sitting there, unable to move, a whole lot of supply trucks, NATO supply trucks, rolled in after Secretary of State Hillary Clinton smoothed over relations. We'll hear some of that, the non-apology apology, but here are the trucks headed in, reported by Reuters.
Trucks in Pakistan carry NATO supplies to Afghanistan, the first vehicles to take this journey in over 7 months.
And, of course, this after Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. was sorry for an airstrike that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers before that road was blocked. Here was a press conference Tuesday where State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland reaffirmed that. You'll hear it's very subtle, but it's in there.
There were mistakes made on both sides that led to the tragic loss of life, and we are both sorry for those. I think the intent here is that we are both sorry for the losses suffered by both our countries in this fight against terrorists.
We are both sorry for those. And, of course, if you take that apart, there's an American sorry in there, too. Doyle, that was a long wait for trucks to get through and some real roundabout $100 million a month expenses and logistics required to keep troops supplied while we waited.
Yeah, and it took U.S.-Pakistani relations to a new low, if such a thing can be imagined, because U.S.-Pakistani relations were at a pretty low point already. The problem here is that inside the U.S. military, there was an absolute conviction that they hadn't really done much wrong, that the Pakistanis fired on U.S. troops, that the U.S. troops didn't know who it was. They called in an airstrike. That is what led to the loss of life on the Pakistani side, and we were darned if we were going to be apologizing for any of that. That was the view inside the military command. It took some time. It took some patience. It took some time to make sure, incidentally, that the Pakistanis would accept that exquisitely balanced both of us apology as an apology. They also wanted more than that.
I'm sure they did, but the trucks are rolling, and we cannot ignore the God particle this week. Scientists announced on Wednesday they finally discovered evidence of the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle. Theoretical physicist Michio Kaku appeared on CNN Wednesday to explain why the discovery matters.
This particle, we think, was in fact a particle like this, was the fuse that set off the explosion which created the universe, so that everything we see around us, the galaxies, the planets, the Earth, life itself, is a byproduct of an explosion which was set off by a Higgs-like particle.
Jack Beatty, the cosmic molasses, the New York Times called it, that permeates space and imbues elementary particles with mass. Where would we be without that? Do you feel better now we've got the Higgs boson nailed down a little bit, Jack?
I certainly do, and when the Times tells me it is to physics what the discovery of DNA was to biology, I almost grasp it. But, you know, casting around for a metaphor for this, I come upon a phrase of Justice Douglas in the Griswold case of the 60s, talking about privacy in the Constitution. He said, privacy exists as a penumbra based upon an emanation.
He was there well before the physicist. Jack Beatty, great to have you with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Doyle McManus with the Los Angeles Times, thanks very much to you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Chrystia Freeland with Thomson Reuters Digital. Thanks so much, Digital.
Chrystia.
Digital Chrystia. Thank you. And listen, we have to say goodbye today to our beloved producer, Ping Wong. She's been a mighty force and beautiful spirit with us these last 4 years. She's going off now to make great things happen in Abu Dhabi. Their gain, our loss. We wish her all the very best. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll go out with a little more Andy Griffith.
We'll have no need to call the roll. When we get to the vision hole, there'll be you, me, and old dog Trey to doodle time away. If we don't hook a perch or bass, we'll cool our toes in dewy grass, or else pull up a weed to chaw and maybe set and jaw.